Welcome to the Resistance Roundtable, which comes to you the second Saturday of each month at 10 a.m. and offers a space for the discussion and listener call-ins on the unprecedented and disturbing political developments of the past couple of weeks. I'd like to welcome our regular panel, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, who teaches in the English department at Central Connecticut State University and is active in the American Association of University Professors. Welcome, Ruth.
Hi.
Great to have you. Scott Harris, the host of Counterpoint on WPKN, which airs Monday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. each week. And he's also the producer of Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, which also airs here at WPKN and on many other stations. I'm Richard Hill. I'm the host of First Tuesday Rainy Day Radio and the Organic Farm Stand on WPKN. Today we'll also be hearing by phone from Lindsay Cannelly, an organizer with the 2018 demonstrations planned for January 20th in Washington, D.C. and many other cities. Lindsay was a lead organizer for the Women's March on Oklahoma, and she's also a member of the March on Board. And as usual, we'll welcome your phone calls, and we'll reserve the second half of the show for those starting at around 10:30. We'll hope to hear your answers to the question, what should the Democratic message be going into the 2018 midterm elections? How should they try to mobilize people? What kind of message and program should they put forward to inspire people to vote in an off-year election? So please call in with your thoughts starting at around 10:30 a.m. And the number to call is 203-336-9756. As is our usual practice, why don't we start with getting to our panelists about some of the issues that we've been focusing on this week. The big one, hard to avoid the hippopotamus in the room, the remarks made by Donald Trump a day or two ago, and the furor that has ensued. Ruth Ann, any thoughts?
Well, you know, I understand that a number of people voted for Donald Trump because, quote, he speaks his mind, and he sure did. Rachel Maddow says that's the biggest weapon against him, because whenever he makes remarks like the remarks he made this week, he gives the entire legal profession ammunition for challenging a number of policies that he tries to put in place, showing motivations behind the words.
I think you were saying earlier that, in fact, a recent court decision about DACA, the judge referred to his racial animus has been expressed in these screeds that he blares out through tweet or actually on live mics.
Absolutely. And I want to talk about that more later.
Scott, your thoughts on Trump's latest madness and beyond?
Well, it's hard to find the words to describe what is going on in the White House these days. And all that came out yesterday was not all that shocking. But what continues to be a surprise is the kind of denial in which most members of the Republican Party, when they speak to the issues of racism, that there's a few outliers within the Republican Party that seem to know what's going on and are reacting in a rational way. But there are so many that basically deny that Trump is a racist. It's just clear. And I thought I would just summarize some of the things that have happened in Trump's life that, you know, it's a slam dunk indicators, set of indicators that he is a certified racist. And it was a good little piece of commentary I saw on one of the cable news channels. So I'll just briefly go down that list. In the 1970s, the Department of Justice launched a lawsuit against Trump for his discrimination against African-Americans in his apartments in New York City. His casinos that he owns were sued for discrimination. In 1991, there was a book written about Donald Trump where he specifically said he didn't want blacks handling his money. He just wanted Jews to manage his funds. Of course, there's the Obama birtherism that he carried on and probably was the reason he won the Republican nomination in 2016. Denying that Obama was a citizen and that he was a Muslim from Kenya and all that nonsense. He launched his presidential campaign with racist attacks on Mexicans as rapists and drug dealers. He certainly made it a huge plank in his campaign to ban all Muslims from entering the United States. He denounced a Mexican-American judge who was sitting on a case that he was involved in as not being capable of fairly judging him. He attacked Gold Star families, specifically black and Muslim Gold Star families, people who lost loved ones in the U.S. military. He's certainly more recently attacked black NFL players for kneeling in their protests against police brutality and police violence. He spoke to the white supremacists marching in Charlottesville as fine people, saying fine people on both sides. And that was, of course, when the death of an anti-racist protester was at the hands of one of these white supremacists. He's spoken more recently about Nigerians living in huts and will never go home. All Haitians have AIDS was another comment. During his early career as a real estate mogul, he paid tens of thousands of dollars for ads in the New York Times, demanding the death penalty for the Central Park Five, who were found to have been innocent of the crime and spent years in jail. They were actually exonerated through the use of DNA evidence, but Trump persisted and spent this money in these full-page ads in the New York Times demanding these people be executed. And more recently, in the Hurricane Maria disaster, in the wake of that disaster, Trump spoke about Puerto Ricans and the victims of the hurricane as being lazy. I mean, we could go on, but there are Republicans and conservatives, you know, in the newspapers and on cable TV news who somehow believe that Trump is not a racist. And, of course, it informs serves as a rationale for all his despicable policies, whether it be advocacy of voter suppression or his just vile policies on immigration. And the idea that Trump invented blatant racism within the Republican Party is just plain wrong. Racism has long been an important element deeply ingrained in the GOP's DNA. And I'll remind people, and I've said this on the air often, but Ronald Reagan launched his very first stop on his 1980 presidential election campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And he talked about states' rights there, a code word for discrimination and advocacy of Jim Crow. Philadelphia, Mississippi, you should know, is not, you know, just some small town in Mississippi that he picked at random. It was the site of the murder of three civil rights workers, James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Mickey Schorner, back in 1964. And certainly a speech in this town was lots more than a subtle dog whistle. How do you launch your presidential campaign in that specific town without speaking to the racism that in the Southern strategy the Republican Party has long adhered? Anyway, I'm going on and on. I'm just going to close with one comment, a quote actually from Robert Borsage, who recently wrote a column about this first year of the Trump presidency. And he writes, "In one calamitous year, Trump has helped rouse the resistance. Movements like Black Lives Matter and Me Too mobilize new energy. The new Poor People's Campaign will revive a moral voice in our politics, as will Moral Mondays and William Barber's movement. Nascent progressive electoral efforts from Our Revolution to the Working Families Party and many more are recruiting and supporting bold reformers. Let us remember Martin Luther King Jr.'s wisdom, where he said, darkness cannot drive our darkness, or excuse me, darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. After 1 year of Trump, we can already see the first rays of light." So a little bit on the optimistic side, an appropriate quote from Martin Luther King on this weekend where we celebrate his life and legacy.
Thanks, Scott. We are definitely in a very, very strange, nightmarish kind of place. I don't know if anybody saw the front cover of the Daily News. I think it was yesterday's cover. Did you folks see that? Let me see if I can remember exactly what it said. I believe it was a picture of a face that was supposed to be Donald Trump that was actually made out of a huge mound of turd with yellow hair. And I believe the headline was Shit for Brains. That was on the front page of the Daily News yesterday, or perhaps they were putting it out today. But that was circulating on Facebook. So what I'd like to do is, in the moments we have before our phone guest arrives, is to talk a little bit about the strategies for 2018. We're a little bit more than a year into what is known as the resistance, and I'm wondering, and perhaps you are too, whether the resistance is girding its loins for the 2018 elections and preparing for what is apparently the Trump administration Republicans to have a full court press to suppress voting and to block and disqualify likely Democratic voters in 2018 and beyond, I should say. So the question is, what are the Democrats and what is the resistance going to do about it? So let's look at some of the data. The Republican multi-pronged strategy for blocking voting and suppressing votes includes the new voter ID laws, which are already in effect and probably more coming, voter purging, which includes cross-state checking, which eliminate strikes voters from polling lists, polling place closures, which we have seen many examples of in 2016, limitations on early voting, both in the locations and in the timing of the early voting, felony disenfranchisement, which is very important in many states, American Disabilities Act violations, which means that 75% of the polling places in our country are not ADA compliant, making it very difficult for Americans with disabilities to actually exercise their vote, and voter intimidation and misinformation, which is pervaded in a systematic way to confuse and intimidate voters from actually coming to the polls. Now, there's an organization called the Strategic Institute for Intersectional Policy, which has put out some data on this. They estimate that 50 to 60 million votes were suppressed in the 2016 election, and they break down the data as follows. Voter ID restrictions, they claim, caused 21 million voters to be deprived of their constitutional right to vote. 21 million voters were affected by voter ID laws and restrictions. Voter purging, over 1 million votes, mostly Black and Latino, were purged from voter registration lists just prior to the 2016 elections. ADA violations, their data show that 1 in 6 or 34 million voters living with disabilities were affected by the fact that 75% of polling places were inaccessible, and therefore 14 million voters with disabilities were not able to vote. We also have the polling place closures, which I mentioned. The Strategic Institute for Intersectional Policy claims that 16 million voters that live below the poverty line and identify as Democrat were unable to cast their ballots because of polling place closures. That is to say, those polling places which used to exist were literally shuttered and eliminated. Felony disenfranchisement, a very important in many states. Over 6 million people nationwide have been prevented from voting because of previous felony convictions. So this gives you some sense of the magnitude of this potential assault on the democratic process. A couple of other details. Ari Berman, who writes for The Nation, in his analysis of voter data from Wisconsin, concludes that over 49,000 mostly African-American, Latino, and youth voters were excluded from voting due to that state's extreme voter ID law, which requires a current driver's license or a state-issued photo ID. And another disquieting development is that just past week, a judge lifted a consent decree against the RNC, which had been in place since 1982, that had barred Republicans from sending intimidating mailers to African-American voters and hiring armed off-duty law enforcement officers to stand and watch polling places, stand around glowering at voters in minority neighborhoods. So with that decree lifted, these practices will no doubt resume in this year's elections. And make a last point, because I think our caller is about to join us. The Department of Homeland Security has been designated by Trump to take over the work of the disgraced Voter Fraud Commission, Kris Kobach's commission, The fear here is that this could be the beginning of an effort by to use DHS immigration databases to match against voter registration lists to try to purge individuals from voter rolls. In shifting their voter suppression efforts to DHS, the administration aims to sidestep the legal obstacles that prevented the commission from successfully collecting sensitive personal identifying information on millions of voters. As you may remember, the secretaries of state of most of the states refused to turn over this information, claiming it was really against regulation and against the law. So, and finally, I just want to say that Democrats won special elections in Virginia and Alabama because of massive turnout by African Americans, especially women. But as Richard Eskow, host of Zero Hour, the Zero Hour podcast, a very good show, by the way, as he notes, Democrats can't passively count on the rising American electorate, unmarried women, people of color, and millennials to rescue them. They need to offer these voters a compelling agenda, one that motivates them to overcome the many obstacles to voting that are being placed in their way. And I'll add to that, shouldn't the DNC now be sounding the alarm and aggressively combating all forms of voter suppression? And shouldn't the DNC be pouring millions of dollars into voter registration in minority districts and preparing for a well-funded ground campaign now through November in these areas as well?
Thanks, Richard. Right now, we'd like to welcome to the program Lindsay Canale. She was a lead organizer for the Women's March on Oklahoma last year and co-founder of the March on Oklahoma. She's also a member of the March on Board, which is organizing protests and rallies to commemorate the outpouring of some 4 million people who came out last year, the day after President Trump was sworn into office. Lindsay, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So first off, just tell us a little bit about the March On concept. What's going on around the country to commemorate the historic, record-breaking number of people who came out to demonstrate against the agenda of Donald Trump the day after he was sworn into office in 2017?
Yeah, sure. You know, last year we had over 5 million women, families, and allies across the world coming out and voicing, having their voices heard in the streets of their local towns, states, to stand up for women's rights, to stand up for marginalized communities, and let people know that we're not going to tolerate this behavior in our own backyard. This year, I believe we have a little over 330 registered marches, anniversary actions, and they range anywhere from a march to a rally to a voter registration event. Anything that kind of commemorates, you know, the mobilization that happened last year, we're trying to carry that forward. March On core mission is really to drive voter turnout and take the mobilization from last year, carry it forward, and really transform our political system into what we want to see. We need representation of women. We need representation of marginalized communities. We need to have a Congress, a state representative, city government all represent the people that actually live in those areas. So that's our main goal this year.
Can I just clarify something? I've been reading about various marches and the banners under which they're being organized, and I've read March on the Polls, which you're affiliated with, Power to the Polls, Weekend of Women. There's a whole bunch of impeachment rallies too, all taking place this next weekend. On the day commemorating the massive women's march all over the country and in Washington, D.C., of course. Can you talk a little bit about the different organizing models that are being put into action?
Yeah, sure. March On is organizing the March on the Polls and the hashtag Weekend of Women. We launched our March on the Polls 2018 initiative in October. And that is literally, you know, what we plan on doing is literally marching people to the polls, whether that's literative or figurative. That is our mission. Power to the polls is something that the Women's March organizers came out with in January. And so we're excited to see all the momentum shift to focusing on elections this year.
And I know we have a local rally taking place on a week from today, next Saturday, in Hartford, Connecticut. New York City mm-hmm. is having a big rally, as is Washington, D.C. And you're based in Oklahoma?
Yes.
And I just wanted to ask, what is taking place in Oklahoma?
Yes, so there's a group that is organizing Indivisible Oklahoma City. I'm sorry. Indivisible Oklahoma City is organizing an anniversary march in Oklahoma City on our state capitol. And then there's another group up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that's organizing a march up there as well. March on Oklahoma is after the march. We are calling on people to come to a local restaurant, get warmed up. We've invited all of our state elected officials and candidates that are running this year. We're partnered up with a nonpartisan group called Women Lead Oklahoma, Freedom Oklahoma, and Let's Fix This, which all focuses on civic engagement, equality for all Oklahomans. And we've invited people to come from the march to come over to the restaurant at Camp 1910 and meet their elected official, learn about all the civic programs that we have going on for 2018 to really drive a lot of civic education, because it's one thing to get people registered to vote, but it's another to actually teach them about civics, about their local government, how they work, what's on the ballot, how to read state questions, how to know when you have an election. You know, we have here in Oklahoma, we have election almost every month this year. It's a combined of a number of special elections that we're having for local representatives, but we also have state question ballots. We have bond questions, everything like that. Well, if people don't know what those mean and what, you know, how to vote on those, then registering them isn't going to mean anything if they're not turning out to vote. So education is key, and that's what we're really focusing on here in Oklahoma.
We're speaking with Lindsay Cannelly, who is an organizer with the 2018 demonstrations that are planned for next weekend in many cities around the country. Lindsay, are you involved at all, and do you know anything about specifically what's going to be happening in Washington, D.C. next weekend? Are hundreds of thousands of people going to converge there as they did last year, and will the media be unable to ignore the numbers based on the calculations you've made so far about what's going to happen in Washington?
Yeah, so in Washington, D.C., there is a march being organized by March Forward Virginia. They have a series of speakers planned. They're an affiliate of March On, and so we're hoping to spread the word. We want, you know, a massive, large demonstration again in D.C., as well as everywhere across the United States.
Well, last year, the numbers were overwhelming. They made world history, the largest of demonstrations on a single day that had ever happened. Is there any concern that it's going to be impossible to equal or better those numbers this year? And if that occurs, if the numbers are demonstrably lower, that the media and the pundits and the Republican establishment are just going to dismiss it and laugh it off as being a failure?
Sure. I know that that's a concern that people have. And the thing is last year's demonstration was the first of its kind. Will this year's top that? I don't know. Will it match it? I don't know. I hope so. But that's really not our focus. Our focus is flipping the House. Our focus is getting women elected in 2018 in their local state on up to Congress. So I think, you know, if the media does say, oh, you know, it wasn't the turnout as it was last year, people are fizzling off or are uninterested, I think that that would be a short-sighted on their point of view, because the difference is going to be seen in the elections, as we've seen in Virginia and Alabama. Here in Oklahoma, last year we had six special elections. Five of those flipped to Democrats, and those were in deep, deep, deep red districts that had been held since the early 1990s. So whether or not that's what the media picks up on, that's what's happening. And that's really all we care about. We're not in this to have the, you know, be on TV and have everybody talk about how great this movement is. We are in it to actually make change on a local level and feed it on up to federal.
I just wanted to ask you, being from Oklahoma, and the fact that Donald Trump won your state 65% to 28%, you know, an overwhelming victory for Trump back in 2016. What do you think has changed over the last year? And you know, anecdotally, speaking with your neighbors, you know, what you hear in the supermarket. I'm just curious, has anything really changed in Oklahoma? Attitudes towards Trump? You know, we hear a lot of interviews with Trump voters saying, I'm sticking with this guy. I love him. You know, he's not a racist. I love this guy, and he's misunderstood, and all these other kind of bizarre rationales for his behavior over these last 12 months. But what are you hearing in Oklahoma? Things changing?
Yeah, actually, they are changing here in Oklahoma, and people are not as vocal with their support of him. They may still support him. There's always going to be, you know, his 30% base that I don't know if they'll ever go anywhere. But here in Oklahoma, we kind of have to, being in a red state, we have to kind of approach things a little bit differently. We're not too concerned with who you voted for in 2016. Here in Oklahoma, we've cut the most in education of any other state in the last 5 years. We rank 49th in teacher pay. We have a budget crisis right now where we still don't have a budget from last year, and we're in our second special session right now with our legislators. So who somebody voted for the national election doesn't really matter, because people are... We have people who voted for Trump in 2016, but they're voting for their local Democrat to get in there and make a change, because our Republicans have completely messed up our entire budget. We don't have funding for core services. So people are not focused on Trump or who's going to be running in 2020 or anything like that. We see people crossing the party line all the time right now. Independents are the fastest growing voter registration here in Oklahoma, and they'll cross party lines if they need to. So there's not as much vocalization for Trump, because we have so much to take care of here in Oklahoma that, you know, what he's doing, it's a tremendous concern to a lot of people. A lot of people would wish he would quit tweeting. That's what I hear the most from people who voted for him, is just, I wish Twitter would just shut down his account and we could just not have him tweet anymore. Mm. You know, that's what I'm hearing. People are just tired of hearing about him and his completely disgusting comments on a daily basis. But we have stuff here in Oklahoma to take care of, so...
Well, Lindsay, before we say goodbye, I wanted to ask you, can you direct our listeners to a website so they can know better the various organizing efforts happening in, as you said earlier, 300 cities across the country? Where would they go to find more details about those marches and those rallies?
Absolutely. So if you go to wearemarchon.org, you'll learn more about March On, sign up to, we like to call it enlist to March On. We have a nationwide poll that's going out on, it's going to open up January 20th. And it's really the first of its kind. It's going to put people in the driver's seat of our movement, of what telling elected officials, you know, what they actually really care about. We'll be able to break it down by geographical location and everything. It's really the first of its kind, so it's exciting what we have going on with that. To look up the sister marches, the anniversary events that are happening across the country, across the world, actually, you can go to marchonthepoles.org, and you'll find an interactive map. Find your location and be able to connect directly with the event organizers and sign up to go to your local anniversary action.
Just one more time for those two websites, if you would.
Yeah, wearemarchon.org and marchonthepoles.org.
Got it. And I'll just leave one more local web address for a local March on Hartford, Connecticut, happening a week from today, womensmarchct.org. You can get details about that local march on the web. Thanks so much, Lindsay. Appreciate you making time to be on our program here on Resistance Roundtable. Thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
And good luck with the march next Saturday.
Thank you. You as well.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Lindsay Canale. She's co-founder of March On Oklahoma and also a member of the National March On Board, the group organizing marches across the country in commemoration of the mammoth Women's March last year after the swearing in of Donald Trump.
Well, we've come to the time in our program where we'd like to open up the phones and encourage listeners to call in and express their opinions on anything. But we're actually trying to focus a little bit on a specific question, which is, what do you think the Democrats' message should be going into the 2018 midterm elections? Should it be just, you know, anybody but Trump and try to ride the horror that many are feeling about the president, the notion that he's unfit, that he's mentally unstable, this kind of thing? Or do the Democrats need to put out a very specific progressive agenda in order to get people inspired and motivated to come out around these specific issues? And the question I raised earlier also, should the DNC be pouring resources into trying to mobilize voters from minority communities who are oftentimes either blocked from voting because of the strategies of the local election machinery and political winds blowing against them? Should the Democrats be really trying to register and motivate and mobilize those voters with specific agenda items, but also giving them the means and knowledge to avoid the pitfalls that are being thrown in their way in the election process? So the number to call, if you'd like to participate in the conversation, is 203-336-9756. And we are the Resistance Roundtable with open phones for your comments. Please join us.
I'd like to begin with my suggestion. Yeah. I believe that the Pledge of Allegiance is not under copyright, and I know that I know no one in the world who wakes up in the morning saying, I want a better deal. I think the Democrat message, the Democratic message, or the Democratic platform has been consistently good. And when generic surveys are made about how people feel about the various components of the Democratic platform, people generally support the whole platform, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. I just want a new slogan, and I think we should just take one that's already on everybody's mouth and every school child every bloody morning, liberty and justice for all. I think that kind of sums up where we try to be, and the way that a number of the Democratic legislative agendas have trend all the time. So that's what we ought to be saying.
I like it. I think it works.
Yeah. And you don't have to, you know, try to remember it because you already do.
Well, I think that the question that we're raising here has to do with the fact that there has been a split, I guess you could say, in the Democratic Party that emerged before the 2016 election when Bernie Sanders put forward a relatively progressive agenda and, in a sense, really forced Hillary Clinton, a centrist Democrat, to endorse programs that she probably would not have done and to include those in her platform, in the Democratic platform. And those platform items tended to be overlooked and ignored by Clinton and also by the media, who didn't want to talk about policy. They'd rather talk about personality. So now we have, once again, I think this split has come to the national level where Tom Perez was selected as the chairman of the DNC over Keith Ellison, who, by the way, is speaking in New Haven today at 1 o'clock. And so, you know, Tom Perez, a sort of centrist Democrat, regarded, I think, by many progressives as being, you know, sort of weak tea when faced with the madness that's going on politically in our country, and that he is not a purveyor of a real progressive agenda or a real progressive strategy for churning out the disenfranchised voters in our country, of which there are millions. So the question is, what should the Democrats do going forward between now and 2018? And we'll hope to hear from some of our listeners at 203-336-9756.
I think we have a caller on the line. Let's find out. Right there. Hi, WPKN, you're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. This is Blair, and I'm calling in about your question. And I don't quite look at it as what should be the message the Democrats should put forward, because I really have no faith that a party is controlled by corporate money as they are, and the majority of whose current elected officials I think have failed to mobilize working people in this country because they don't have a message that appeals to them. I think we have to remember that even in elections, presidential elections, in which there's supposedly a lot of interest, the United States barely gets 50% of its eligible voters to vote. And most of those who are just plain not voting are working class people. And to them, that neither party has a message for them, and they're not motivated to vote. But I think that certain Democratic candidates, people who are running as Democrats, do have a good message. And they run as Democrats very often because of the way our electoral system is set up, you know, which is winner take all. They're worth supporting. And they've got to have a message that advocates for programs and policies that are really going to help people and mobilize them. And I think there also got to be candidates that really try to organize and motivate that constituency, which is, I think, one thing you were talking about. I mean, I worked for years in Connecticut on electoral campaigns, and even within the labor movement, you would bring up the issue of voter registration and, you know, trying to bring new people in, getting them to vote, and you were basically, nope, forget it. We've got to concentrate on the people who do vote and win them over, and, you know, we haven't got time, you know, for that other stuff. It won't pay off. You know, we don't need to do it. That's what you often get. And then you're trying to appeal to a rather reduced, more conservative electorate. So I think that's, and I think there are plenty of newer candidates that are coming up around the country at various levels of government, from local government up to the federal level.
Blair, this is Richard. thank you for calling. I just wanted to add to your comment there, or maybe tweak it a little bit by saying that the special elections in Virginia and Alabama, the victories really were resulted from larger than expected turnouts from the African American communities in Alabama, apparently specifically African American women. And this split that I mentioned before in the Democratic Party and in terms of strategizing, I think where Keith Ellison, the chairman of the DNC,
he's not the chairman.
I know, but if he were, his strategy would have been the very thing that you said that regular Democrats generally avoid, which is the idea of registering the disenfranchised, trying to mobilize communities that don't normally vote. And these two special elections, I think, have demonstrated that if you work at the street level on getting those folks to vote, they will come out. But you have to give them a good reason to do so. In Alabama, the reason was quite obvious. Many reasons.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, in Alabama, I think that the reason was more negative than anything. Like, you know, we want to stop Roy Moore. You know, not that the Democratic candidate was some great, you know, paladin of progressivism. I mean, he's a fairly good Democrat. I mean, that's what he is. But I think candidates have to go beyond that if we're going to get real, you know, change in this country and really motivate other people to vote. Because even in Alabama, if I remember correctly, it was somewhere in the between 30 and 40% of the eligible voters voted in that primary. So,
right. It actually turned out to be a higher percentage of African Americans that voted in that election than they did in 2016, which is quite remarkable, I think.
Blair, I just wanted to ask your view on the question of how important is rearranging, toppling the current hierarchy and leadership within the Democratic National Committee. How important is that, if at all important, to the efforts all over the country to flip the House of Representatives and maybe the Senate, too, in the 2018 midterm election?
Well, I don't see that as something that is going to happen in the immediate future. If it ever is going to happen, and I have my doubts, it's going to come because there are more Democrats elected that aren't going to put up with that type of leadership. I mean, one of the problems now is that the majority of, I think, elected Democrats probably don't have an issue with the leadership of Tom Perez. It's a lot of work at the grassroots level, and if that's ever going to be, you know, done, that's how it's going to have to happen. Because despite, I think, what's happening, let me go to an aside. I mean, evidence of this is this Democratic focus on Russia. I mean, you guys went over how, you know, the real problem with voting in this country is voter suppression by basically Republican state governments and local officials. That is what is skewing our elections. And yet, you know, when the Democrats focused on this Russia thing, thinking that, you know, if they could just gin that up and it comes to fruition, they could maybe get rid of or weaken Trump, and it keeps them from doing any real self-examination of why they failed so miserably, and have failed miserably for decades, actually, as the Republicans have taken over one state house after another across the country, and then eventually ended up electing a person like, you know, Colt 45 that we've got in the White House now.
Well, Blair, maybe you could offer some words of hope, but from your vantage point of being a labor activist for many years, what do you expect will happen in the elections in 2018? And what needs to be done between now and November to actually affect change?
Well, I would think, if the trends keep going from what I'm seeing, that the Democrats have an opportunity to flip both houses of Congress. Maybe not by a lot, but I think they have that opportunity. What worries me is what happens often on the state level, because you know, the Republicans are running their agenda at both of those levels. And sometimes the most damaging policies are instituted at that level. So there has to be some focus on that also. Otherwise, you can do a lot of things. You know, at best, they're going to get a Congress that's going to hopefully block a lot of what the Trump administration tries to accomplish. And I think looking at it from the perspective of the labor movement right now, you know, there's somewhat of a at least certainly among many public sector unions, there's a focus on the upcoming Janus decision, which we believe we're going to lose 5-4, most probably, which is going to affect public sector, unionized public sector workers all across the country, and probably lead to some fall off of members.
Is this
the challenge for us at the moment is to help, you know, stem that as much as possible. But I think our challenge is how do we rebuild the mass labor movement? We've been so weakened, and I think without it, there isn't going to be real progressive change in the United States.
The Janus decision you were talking about affects the mandatory dues?
It affects what are called agency fees. In other words, if we lose it in the worst possible way, it'll make every public sector worker at every level of government in the U.S. basically in what is called an open shop, meaning that there will be no more agency fees. I mean, currently, for example, in Connecticut, if you go to work for a town or a city or whatever, if you don't actually sign the union card, you still have a deduction made from your pay to help pay for the services that the union is obligated to provide to everyone in the bargaining unit. That will be done away with, and it will also mean that it'll make it easier for members to drop out, and the right wing will have a propaganda campaign to try to get members to drop out because the Koch brothers and the other billionaires that are funding all this stuff, including these court cases, are then going to launch a well-funded propaganda campaign aimed at union members to get them to disaffiliate. And it's going to be a tough situation. And some unions are better prepared for it than others.
All right. I think we're almost out of time here, but thanks for calling in, Blair. Appreciate your perspective on the
elections. Okay. Keep
elections.
Up the good works, guys. It's always good hearing you, and I'm glad you're doing this type of program. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye. And we're coming into the end of the program. Richard?
I want to thank Ruth Ann, Scott Harris, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Scott Harris, and my name is Richard Hill. This has been the Resistance Roundtable, and we will be back the second Saturday of, February? My God, we are rushing headlong into another madcap year.
And I think we have just a couple of these websites to give out before we say goodbye for this morning. Women'sMarchCT.org will give you information about the Hartford Women's March this Saturday in Hartford, Connecticut. And WeAreMarchOn.org is a national site, as is MarchOnThePolls.org. We'll give you information about protests and rallies on the anniversary of the Trump swearing-in this coming weekend. And I guess that's it for our program today. Thank you for listening. And we'll be back the second Saturday of February.